The 1995 Sandstone Symposium presents section number 236, Art in the Circle of Life, with me and John Banyan.
See what they look like.
Well, once we get a slide up, we're going to have plenty of light.
Okay, we're fine.
First of all, I'm sort of happy to be in such a small venue so that I won't get nervous, because there can't be too many people in here. The first reel of slides that we've brought are sort of background for both of us, and I feel that the background is pretty important to show. There were some things written in the program prospectus about something about balancing life and relationships, and it also said something about how art is forged most effectively in solitude. And I'd like to address that a little bit in what I say, because actually I have worked to keep my art out of the idea of solitude, but the things I do are pottery. And actually I would also say that the way art is defined and treated in our culture, I sometimes would prefer not to be known as an artist. At any rate, this is a picture of me about the time I met Lee in what was to that point my best place, which was the Uinta Mountains in northeastern Utah. And this was Lee at the same time. I just so you'll see that at one time we were really young and innocent looking instead of much older and wiser. We met at BYU and spent our honeymoon down in Moroni, Utah, of all places, this resort capital of central Utah. This is a photograph of Spring City, and while we were honeymooning in the area, we determined that that was where we wanted to live. Lee and I had grown up in smallish places, Orem, Utah, and Merced, California, but had watched them become much changed by the advance of malls and recording studios and those sorts of things, and went looking for a place, not so much a place that we could be able to sell art, but a place much like what we would like to have grown up with. And as I look back, 30 years ago, Orem was very much like Spring City is now, only it covered more ground. But we made a conscious decision in favor of our children, our future children, where they would have a place to grow up and it'd have some space, some freedom from asphalt, you know, all those good things that you read about in the Waltons, I guess. And so I'm going to show you pictures of Spring City. This is west of town, looking back at the mountains. What is called down there Air Mountain, which means our mountain. This is the home we live in now, before we tore into it. Again, with Air Mountain in the background. This is a view from our front steps looking west across David and Rosie Hamblin's lot. And the old school, which is currently being restored as a community art center. This is the view looking east from our meeting house. And this is the meeting house built in 1902. Pardon me. The building came treacherously close, or dangerously close, to being demolished in the 70s during the Fetzer era, and Osaral, a local watercolor painter who was at the time the bishop in Spring City, fought tooth and nail to save the building. And about the time we came to Spring City, there was an addition being made to the north of the building, and now it's one of the nicer solutions to changing forms in the church, as far as keeping the old and making it function like a new. Some of the old buildings around town, the Relief Society Granary and the so-called Endowment House. This is the capstone, or whatever you call it, on the so-called Endowment House with the so-called Masonic symbols. Oh, yes.
And Randall.
If you'd like a discussion on that, we could... it was the marks were removed in the I believe the 1960s. Anyway, the building currently belongs to Randall Lake, and he had Benson Whittle whittled them back on with his hammer and chisel. This is Spring City from the mountain, from up on Air Mountain, looking down at the valley and the town. And this is looking exactly the other way from where that picture was taken, up at the mountain. This is a formation called the Horseshoe, which is what I take the name of my pottery from, Horseshoe Mountain Pottery. These mountains are pretty important to us. Without them, we would have very little existence in our town. They catch the water, which seeps down slowly over the year and keeps us green and keeps us in water. And they are very much a parent figure to the valley as far as providing and working into the system of how we're able to survive there. And the bears and elk like it up there, too. This is our backyard garden from several years past. Gardening is very important to us, to me especially. I grew up in a large family in Orem where we ate a lot of our food from the garden, and I've kind of carried that on.
Sharing it with the bugs.
Excuse me?
Looks like you're sharing it with the bugs.
Well, yeah, this last slide will demonstrate effectively that I'm an organic gardener. But, you know, they have a hard time getting into the very heart, and so what we don't eat, we then feed to the rabbits in the compost pile. But anyway, I'd like to read a little bit to you from a talk that I delivered down in Tempe, Arizona a few years ago, and I'll refer back to this talk a couple of times, and this will be the only canned part of my presentation. But it says, each year we increase the size and quality of our garden. We build the soil and grow our food carefully so that the wisdom of the earth can come to us clearly. The growth of the soil is tied to the growth of the family. The garden teaches us that life moves in a circular path. There is constant return and renewal. This is quite different from the linear city mind, which advocates consumerism and erodes our quality of life, undermining the health of our bodies and spirits. In my garden and in my studio, I find work to be a form of worship and communion. Popovida of San Ildefonso Pueblo said this about our connection to food. Quote, our Pueblo people eat gently, recognizing with inner feelings that the corn or squash were at one time growing, cared for, each plant alive, now prepared to become part of us, our bodies and our minds, quite sacred. We reflect on the plant. Now let me point a finger at you. You buy a can of corn or squash in the supermarket, the cans are cans. Things on a shelf, moribund. You even have powdered potatoes. You don't know how they grow or the designs that these plants can create within the mind. You have withdrawn from the basic natural environment, from what we look upon as reality. There is a design in living things. The shapes, forms, the ability to live all have meaning. Unquote. Or end of quote. For me, the whole process of growing, storing, preparing, and finally eating food is a ritual cycle that culminates at the dinner table, with the family and friends joining hands to give thanks and to partake. It is a communion between the earth and the body, a celebration of our physical nature and the renewal of our energy. It is significant to me that the clay vessels that we use at the table are made of the most common minerals or elements in the earth's crust, alumina, silica, and water. They are figuratively the umbilical cord through which she feeds us. And of course, the fruit of the earth is to gladden the eye as well as to fill the belly, as Joseph Smith said in the Doctrine and Covenants. What I'd like to do now is kind of take you through a family album, and it might seem like overkill, but I'm making a point, which is that this next bunch of slides are what Lee and I felt were the most important thing in our life, and the thing that we gave our highest priority and consideration to as we looked for a place to live and how we would make our living. At the time we met, I was studying to be an elementary school teacher at BYU. I was student teaching in the first and the fourth grade, and Lee convinced me to drop out of that program and to go into art. I was already making pottery, but to pursue art and pottery making specifically as a profession, because it would allow me the freedom to be present for my children, to be in the home, and for them to be in my studio easily and to not just disappear on them for 40 hours a week. Children having children. Louisa was born on the 14th of August, 1977. Became the Good Shepherd. One of the things that we did when we moved to Spring City was we blew up the TV. Actually, it blew up itself. We had gone to Arizona to visit family. And when we came home, we talked on the trip about getting rid of the thing. And when we walked in the door, within 5 minutes, I had turned it on to see what was on. And it made a noise and smoke came out the back, and that was the last time it worked. Zina was born on the 7th of September. That would have been 1979, 2 years after Louisa. During the early years, Lee spent a lot of time helping me in the pottery. At the time that Louisa was born, Lee had been drawing and painting quite a bit and had thought that she would continue, but and had enrolled in some classes at BYU. And when she went back up to school and sized things up, and when she got home from the hospital with her baby, she realized she had something bigger at hand, and for 6 years didn't paint or draw much at all, almost not at all, and came back to it after the kids were in school. And I'll let her talk more about that as she shows her slides. Ada Lee was born on the 23rd of January, 1988, sort of an afterthought. Actually, at the time, I think the thought had been that there would be a pair of children during that part of our life. But when Ada was about maybe a year old, Lee said, "This is the little red caboose." And that red hair does go clear to the bone. Everything you've read about redheads is true in this child, at least. One of the most self-confident and outgoing people I've ever met, and very sure of what she wants and how she's going to get it. I'm told that Jesus and Abraham both had red hair, and I think maybe Lucifer too. When I first moved to Spring City, a fellow that was running the grocery store sold me some seeds for my garden, and he also ran a backhoe, and he says, "You know, it's really stupid to do this, because I could go out in an afternoon and make enough money with my backhoe to buy vegetables." And I said, "Then what would your children do?" Louisa is a writer. Is going off to Cornell in 2 weeks to pursue creative writing. Zina, well, both girls have had love affairs with horses off and on, and both as they've gotten older and discovered boys have gotten less interested in horses. There's Louisa with our best shot at a male child, at least until he went to the vet. Zina is in mourning this week for St. Jerome Garcia. And there's Mom. The other thing that I would like to talk about in terms of emphasis and background in our life is the desert. Several times Lee and I have thought about moving somewhere else where it would be easier to sell art. But we couldn't get further than a two-hour drive from the desert. This thing about making art in solitude, I guess if you consider making art the time when you incubate and think about it, then I would say that's when it's made. Lee can talk more about how she makes paintings. She needs to be alone when she's drawing and composing. I would rather have people around. My hero, Hamada Shoji, who's a Japanese potter, said that he made his best pots when he invited a friend over to visit with him, so that he took his conscious mind off the clay and let his body mind produce. And that's kind of the thing that happens. You sometimes go into a bit of a trance while at the wheel. And quite often my thoughts are several hours away in this desert while I'm working on the wheel or talking with a friend.
Where was that?
That's down in the Escalante Canyons, Coyote Gulch. That's probably, and this is inside that alcove, it's for me probably one of the most sacred places I've been. for personal reasons and just in general. When the girls were old enough to carry their own pack with their sleeping bag and panties in it, we started taking them to the desert. I think Zina was 5 and Louisa was 7. And they have loved going back over and over and over again to these places. I love the way the wind and water and sky relate and carve this thing. The ongoing process of creation is very evident in the desert for me. And I will say, if any of you, at the risk of sounding political, please talk to your senators about the current Utah Wilderness Bill. It is a non-wilderness bill. It's an affront to the desert and shouldn't be passed, should be vetoed. H.R. 1500, the House's bill, I think is much more adequate. And I do think this land needs to be protected, needs to be kept out of the reach of people like Texaco and Gulf and Mid-Continental Oil, not to mention Analdex. End of political statement. I used to think that the desert didn't affect my pots in a visual way, and I was showing these slides once, and later you'll see the images of the pots, and one student spoke up and said, "Au contraire, Pierre. Your pots are very much about these forms and these surfaces and these colors." And as I thought about it, I realized, yeah, I guess so. But it was definitely not a conscious thing. I think that the things that you really love go really deep in your heart, and then they come up like springs at times you wouldn't expect while you're working, and you don't remember that that's what you're doing. It's not a conscious act at all, but rather it's how art happens. It's through the unconscious act. This is still in the desert, just the real deep, wet part of the desert. This is in Zion. And again, I hope that you don't feel that these slides are going on too long, but this stuff is very, very important. The access to solitude, the access to this kind of beauty is important in the process. Another thing I would suggest, besides going to the desert, is that you book it over to the Church Museum of History and Art and look at the exhibit about Native American art. The first section there about the Navajo concept of Hojo is very, very important. To live in... Pardon?
One more week on that exhibit.
Is that right? One more week. It's just, I went in, and as I walked through the opening part about the Navajo way of beauty, I wept in the museum. I just was overcome. Because of the respect of this culture for the Mother Earth and for walking in beauty and making beauty a part of everything you do. And the whole concept of Hojo, it's not a visual beauty, it's a spiritual beauty that's very intense. I'm often asked when people see us heading off to the desert to spend a week or so, what are you going to do for water? This is Marble Canyon, and I think that's the last desert shot. I'll switch quickly to pottery pictures, which is probably what you came for. More deserts. I do want to talk a little bit about the native people of the American Southwest. And again, eat your heart out, Frank Lloyd Wright. The way of living that is so close to the forms that are there and the sense of what is there. These are all pictures I lifted from a picture book of Mesa Verde. This is Chaco Canyon. The detail, the craftsmanship, the obvious care, and out of that comes the beauty, which is maybe intentional, but not as conscious as one would think. And I don't mind referring to these as primitive cultures. As we, this is African, switching from the American Southwest to Africa. I am very inspired by indigenous cultures of North America and Africa. And I use the word primitive because of its connection to the root word prime or primary. This is, by the way, a potter's house. Potters in Western Africa are all women. And I once attended a lecture in which a description was given of a ceremony that lasted for a week in which the main focus was the head potter, who was a woman, and how she carried through the village a pottery vessel with stones in it submerged in water. And these stones were representing the children emerged in amniotic waters. And it was terrific. I would dare say that a young woman growing up in an Apache or a Nigerian culture would not have much embarrassment over her first period. And no, no question about what her role was in the culture and in the religion. These are houses in Cameroon. Again, eat your heart out, Frank Lloyd Wright. As far as an integration with the surroundings and made right out of what's there growing. One last comment before I leave these two cultures is the other thing that's very important to me about them is their sense of animation, that these rocks have as much life in them as the thatch that made the roof, and that stones and rivers and mountains are people also, are part of the earth, which has a soul and is the mother and provider for us. My pottery is very much derived from Japanese traditions. This is a Chinese bowl, but in a Japanese collection. The Japanese were really excited about the Chinese bowls and the Korean, but the ones that were made for folk use, they elevated to the status of rare objects in their tea ceremony. Here's a collection of tea objects, and if you know anything about the tea ceremony, it's basically a cult, if you will, of aesthetics that celebrates the simplicity and naturalness and the quiet restraint in nature. This is where I make pots in Spring City. It was a building that was used as a tavern and a five and dime store. And during the Depression, some people lived in here. I bought the building in 1977 or 78 and started retrofitting it for my use. This is the showroom, and this is the back section where I mix clay and make glazes. And this is the wheel that I use. And I chose this type of a wheel because I like its how it demands, the demands that it makes on my body, that I be constantly involved in the powering of the wheel. And I'd like to read just a very short quotation from one of my heroes, Wendell Berry, in a book called What Are People For? He wrote an essay called Feminism, the Body and the Machine. And he says, the body does not work like that. The body characterizes everything it touches. What it makes, it traces over with the marks of its pulses and breathings, its excitements, hesitations, flaws, and mistakes. On its good work, it leaves marks of skill, care, and love persisting through hesitations, flaws, and mistakes. And to those of us who love and honor the life of the body in this world, these marks are precious things, necessities of life. And I would like to say that if I were to characterize my art, I would say it would be art that is intended to celebrate the life of the body, to embellish the life of the body, which we should know is the life of the soul. These are some early pots of mine going back to about 1975. These are from an exhibit that I had at BYU that year. In fact, Lee saw this exhibit before she met me and was, as I recall, fairly unimpressed. During the early years that I was working in Spring City, Lee and I did a lot of art fairs all over the place, and this is obviously one in Salt Lake City. I found that the art fairs were beginning to dictate the direction of my work and were starting to affect the kind of pots I made. The street is a really tough place for art to survive because the race there is not to the most swift, but to the most loud and the most blue and the most shiny. And my work began to drift into a direction that was more acceptable to a mass market, into a street market, where you had to catch people's attention very quickly. And I'm not saying that these are bad pots, but they were not coming from my heart. They were not coming from my wellspring. I was making them, Lee was decorating them, and that making was pretty much dictated by what would sell quickly. And at some point, I realized that I wasn't having fun. And I decided a long time ago that one of the things I would have in life was fun. And I left off potting and went to school at BYU, got into an MFA program, and made things other than pottery for a while. This was a drawing that I did for a class with Alex Duraeus, a self-portrait, actually. And this led into a whole series of work that was very non-vessel and caught somewhere between pottery and sculpture, because it's not really sculpture. It's mostly linear, mostly surface. Definitely not three-dimensional. But rather clay as a canvas or a carving board or some kind of a surface for images. During that time, I came in contact with Japanese pots for the first time in terms of really noticing them. This was at the De Young Museum in San Francisco at Golden Gate Park. This is a Bizen water jar. And I read the works of Bernard Leach and Soetsu Yanagi and started radically changing the direction of my work. Came back to school and started making pottery. It was suggested at that time by my committee chairman that if I continued to make pottery, I should be dropped from the program. And that was probably the best thing he could have said, because as my dad would testify, if you want me to not do something, leave me. What am I trying to say? When you tell a kid he can't do it, that's almost like do it. And by telling me I couldn't make pots, that sort of sealed my doom, and I was to become a potter. Well, it's this whole academic argument about art and craft, about, again, separating art from the life of the body, separating art from the life of the household, and putting it into the temple or the museum, which is the museum is the temple of the art gods. And that art that serves the life of the body is somehow not as important as art that serves the life of the mind. And if you want to really break that down, you have this whole thing of the general denigration of feminine power that goes on in Western culture, in which the life of the body is somehow less, and the life of the mind, the masculine realm, is that's the important thing. But I don't think that was being intentionally spoken to me, but I think that was the roots of what was happening there. And I just decided to duck my head and run straight at them. What happened was, some of these pots, this last one here got in a very important national show in Pennsylvania. This was in a national invitation or juried show down in Texas. Very ordinary, mundane pots. And one of the words that I started using to describe my pots was mundane, taking as its root the word mundus, the earth, of the body, of the world, from that whole feminine side of things, and becoming dogmatically oriented on the household and feeding and storing and preparing food and these sorts of things. At least in terms of what I was talking about. One of the things that we did learn in school, and it wasn't actually taught, these are all pots from my MFA project show at BYU. One of the things that was never taught outwardly but was really ingrained into us was you need to get famous by noon tomorrow, you've got to get published, you've got to get on the lecture circuit, because that's how you're going to get a job in academia. And so I went on the road and did all those things and was able to get my MFA, because after all, if a student is publishing and lecturing, then they must be good enough to passed through the program. And it was very much a thing about the emperor's new clothes. But I realized after some time in my studio at home, after school had finished and the dust was starting to settle, that I was still making pots with publishers and critics and curators in mind instead of moms and dads and kids. Doing a talk about utility and about the life of, you know, all this hand-to-mouth stuff. But in my mind, as I loaded my kill, I was looking for those one or two pieces that were going to get on the cover of Ceramics Monthly or the Rolling Stone or whoever was looking at pottery then. And I will not... I hope this doesn't sound like an apology for these pots, because I think they're good pots, and I'm still very happy about them. But in retrospect, that was very much what I was thinking about as I was making these, was getting attention rather than getting into households. And, of course, there's a whole different price structure when you're looking at museums rather than households.
What is the function of this long green shape?
Well, that's the thing. They're sort of loosely based on functional pots, but, you know, is this a bean pot? Is this a spaghetti server? But the feet look really good in magazines. And I'm just pointing this out as something that I really only became aware of about 5 years ago. It struck me that I was still trying to please the overlords of academia instead of what was in my heart. And it was just something I picked up almost by osmosis, by being around so many people that were so preoccupied with publication. And that's not to say publication is a bad thing. I probably need to backtrack a little bit. I think it's fine. But it was not what was really I was talking about, and it was not where I wanted to be. And I know lots of people making tremendous art, which is being mostly produced to get published, and it's great stuff. But it was out of step with what I was saying that I was doing. This is a piece I made in Japan. Sold it for $500. It's only 4 inches tall. There's something different there than making for everyday use. These are very stretched out, elongated, or stretched up versions of the smaller baking dishes, mainly at the suggestion of certain gallery owners and designers that wanted taller pots for different situations. They do function quite nicely as vases, though. On this one, think back to the sandstone in the slides earlier. This is where I just didn't realize how it was percolating up. It's a very small drinking cup, probably 2 inches tall only. Don't let the size of the slide fool you. At some point, I got a friend who is a bookbinder to start making boxes for these to make them more precious. And again, if there's a fancy box with gold leaf on the inside of the lid, you can ask more for it. And this is what the overlords of the galleries and the museums like. About 4 or 5 years ago, I started thinking consciously about reversing this trend in my work. Not so much to deny it, but just to move into something else, to really bring the pots home, both in terms of their emphasis and their pricing structure and also the location of where I'm selling them. And I can say probably 95% of my work now is sold in Spring City directly. Pardon? No, these are still the gallery pieces. Little stash box of some sort. Here's a bread pan. This is probably more like what I'm making now. I would like to contrast this with the next one. That was a new bread pan out of the kiln. This is a pair of them that had been in our oven and in our cupboard for years and years, baking bread, lasagna, meatloaf, as such. And what I'd like to point out here is the wonderful patina that happens with use. I realize that as you take a pot from the kiln and take it into a household, it continues to change. It develops cracks and chips, and dirt gets worked into these crackles, and grease gets baked into the bottom. And it picks up this wonderful patina, which I would call the testimony of life. And I value pots much more that have been used in this way and have picked up these kinds of marks and colorations than pots that are fresh and new and that have been kept pristine in their mint condition. This, of course, is the best way to appreciate a pot. It's a butter dish that's in use in our cupboard right now. This was a companion piece to it that I did. Actually, both of these pieces were done at a demonstration at an elementary school and somehow made it into our house instead of out into the shop to be sold. Salad bowl. Cereal bowl. Teapot. Herbal, of course. That's my mug. It's in the cupboard. This mug was also featured in a show in Illinois called the Clay Cup. It's a big national competitive show of all kinds of cups, both conceptual and actually useful. And The juror, when he wrote his essay about the show, simply said of this piece, "I had to put it in because it begged to be used." And that spoke to him. Serving bowl. About 2 years ago, I built a new kill, and these next slides are a work out of my new kill. And you'll notice a difference in the surfaces. I don't know if I want to get too much into a technical explanation of what's going on. Just these are glazes applied to the pots, whereas in the others, it was a salt firing method where the glazes actually are more part of the pot. Salt is put into the kiln, which causes a glaze to develop right on the surface. Reaction between the sodium and the salt and the materials in the clay. It's about a 17-inch serving piece. This is about as highly decorated as my work ever gets. A little bit of splash here and there. Very much borrowing from Japanese folk traditions. About a 10 or 12 inch dinner plate. And a baking dish, 3-quart capacity. The mark that I put on my pots, rather than signing my name, I just put a mark. It's a archaic Hebrew character that a friend at BYU identified for me. And it means, "Praise ye the Lord." It's taken from the imagery of one praying with their hands raised. And I wanted something on the pots that reminded me, in a personal way, of what the direction of life should be, to do, to give recognition to the source of creation. I would like to maybe just, while this image is up, read something to you, again from this old lecture that I gave down in Arizona. Conscious of the life and will of the material, I enjoy this dance that we engage in, as the clay moves against my hands and finally yields, assuming the shape that I've intended for it. As I work with the clay and later inspect the finished pots, I always discover clues of my subconscious life that emerge in the process and are revealed in the product. A lot is said in art about creativity. By calling ourselves creative, I think we sometimes take too much credit to ourselves. We are part of creation. To understand and occupy our place in creation is to be creative. The originality so often emphasized in art is an estrangement from the creation. Creativity is not about novelty. It is about integration. That's maybe something I would like to constantly remind myself of, is the fact that the ideas and the shapes of these pots aren't really mine. And this whole idea of calling ourselves creative, I think, is trying to steal thunder from our Father. It's about a 12-inch salad bowl. It's a cookie jar, peanut butter jar. The glazes that I use now are Japanese in origin. This is a Shino glaze. The black one that I've been showing is a Temoku glaze. This is the Temoku glaze. There's a whole universe in this glaze. It's got really a lot going on in it, if you look at it closely. This is a little cereal bowl. A tea bowl. And a vase. I'd like to end with this slide and with just one more statement from Wendell Berry from the same essay, Feminism, the Body, and the Machine. He says, "We have no need to contrive and dabble at the future of the human race. We have only the same need that we have always had, to love, care for, and teach our children." Thank you. Good shape.
more slides. This is my studio, right next to the house. This cabin wasn't always there. We moved it onto our lot about 4 years ago. It was in totally derelict condition about a mile away from where we live. And I was looking for studio space because I'd been painting in the kitchen for several years, and then I moved into the bedroom, and I finally decided I was either going to quit painting or get a place to paint. And so we wouldn't have the paint smell in the house all the time and wet frames and paintings laying all over the house. So we found this little cabin, and with the help of some friends, got it moved over and had a carpenter working on it for about 6 months before it was ready to inhabit. This is an interior shot, painting in progress. You can see I start on a toned canvas, and I always start with a charcoal drawing and paint on top of that. And if any of you have any questions, feel free to ask as I'm going along. I basically will show pictures and just talk about what they are. They're in semi-chronological order, I think at least by a year. This is a painting I did when I went back to school in 1983. I think I had only taken my first painting class the semester before I dropped out of school. I was scared to death of color, had only done drawing and printmaking classes because I was very comfortable drawing. But I realized I was not going to be able to graduate unless I had to take some painting classes. So I finally took one, and it was sort of love at first brushstroke. I found that I loved working with color. And I had that one class, and then, like Joe said, I also had a child. We were 65 miles away. I dropped out of school and basically was not painting or even drawing much for about 6 years, doing lots of reading and doing lots of personal growth and by no means staying stagnant. And then I went back to school in 1983, first paintings that happened after that. And all of these paintings are starting from then on. This was Zina the year that I went back to school. And Louisa. One advantage I found that I had over other art students, I was so worried about going in and competing with all these kids. I thought, oh, they're all working at it, and I'm, you know, been at home for 6 years. And I was very scared about that, but I found that I had a big advantage over all of them in that I had a life. And I had no problem, you know, coming up with ideas for paintings or knowing what I wanted to do. And most of the biggest concern or the biggest question most art students have is, what should I draw? What should I paint? And I had no problem with that. This is when I was painting in the kitchen. When I was ready to hang my BFA show, I needed to make some frames, or I needed frames, and a neighbor of mine, Ella Peacock, some of you might be familiar with her work. She will be turning 90 this September, and she really taught me more about the craft of painting when I moved to Spring City than anyone else. She had studied art in the 1920s back east, and she taught me how to clean my brushes out properly so I didn't ruin them. She taught me how to stretch and prepare canvas. And she also taught me how to build and carve my frames. And so you can see the frames here. This is a painting I did of Zina. I think this is right after my graduation. It's one of the first paintings I did after school, sitting in a tub. This is a painting I did of a friend who would come over and visit me every year. She has known my family since, I was probably in first grade. She's the same age as my sister, a year or two older, and she would drive over every year from California to visit, and she would read about 8 books while she was visiting me. So I would always do a painting or two of her while she's reading. And I think that painting is hanging in the Salt Lake City County building. Someone has told me that. This is Ella, the woman I was talking about who taught me so much about the craft of painting. And it's also been a tremendous mentor to me in the sense of someone who's kept working throughout her life. She had great spaces of time when she was working as a mechanical draftsman, and doing other things to help support her family. And she really only started painting actively when she retired around 65, to where she was giving it the kind of time that she'd been able to give it when she was in art school. This painting is from back then, too. It's called Turning Towards the Light. And started out basically just as a self-portrait I was doing in the kitchen, and I have these big geranium plants on the island where my stove is, and I put them in as background. And then I was faced with the dilemma, what do I call this thing? And one thing that I noticed about the geraniums is that I always have to keep turning the pots because they keep leaning out towards the big windows in the kitchen. And I thought they're always turning towards the light. I thought how we should be like that as people, constantly turning to the light. In fact, I think the opposite is true. We're constantly turning away from the light. It'd be nice if someone could turn our pots, keep us turning towards the light. And so to me, this painting became a symbol of repentance, how our lives we should remember to be like the plants and keep turning and shifting our course so that we are facing towards the light. This is a little still life I did of a picture that we have Joe found out near his family's homestead on the West Desert near some dugouts where there were several wives living. And this, a little lip of this picture was sticking out from the ground. He dug it up. And it's just always been kind of precious to me, the harsh life these women had out there in these dugouts. And something like this must have been a little brightness, one of the few nice things they must have had. And the tablecloth is an old, I think Pioneer vintage woven tablecloth I found in the barn when we moved to Spring City. This is a piece that's called Pioneer Tree, I think. That's what we always called these poplars around town to our little girls, because the pioneers had planted them so they would get some quick shade. Most of the really old ones are dead. They don't have a very long lifespan. There's a lot of these dead poplars around, and I really quite like them. When I paint still life, I've never done it out on location. I tried it once with Ella. Ella goes out painting still lifes, and she does great at it. And I have to be in my studio. I basically paint still life from memory, about things that I've seen and experienced and have really strong feelings about. So that actual tree does not exist exactly the way I painted it. It's just sort of a memory painting of how I feel about those trees. This is Zina holding a peacock feather. This is called Waning Moon, and it's what I call one of my therapy paintings. You know how it is. You know, you're not always as in tune with your spouse or other people in your life as you would like to be. Those things are sort of cyclical, and they come and go, and at times you feel like your heart is waxing, and at times you feel like it's waning. But the fact that I use the moon to symbolize this, to me, is a hopeful thing, because it does not imply that it is shrinking away forever. I know that those relationships are in constant flux, and you have to work at it. But when I feel that way at times, I've done several of these paintings over the years when I'm feeling kind of blue, and like I say, I call them my therapy paintings, and they are great therapy because I feel a lot better after I paint them, and then I can sell them and get paid for them too. Really cheap therapy. This is a friend, or a daughter of one of my roommates from school. I drove out to Colorado to spend some time with her, and she was having an illness and took my paints. This is her daughter. This is a cactus that it doesn't quite look like that, but it's similar in my kitchen window, which does not look like that. And there's a house out the back door, or my cabin you would see. And again, with my still life, it's the same thing as my landscapes. I kind of use a few objects here and there to get me started, or sometimes not at all. Some of the still lifes you'll see are totally out of my head. But they are objects that I'm familiar with, and they are windows and views that mean something to me and are saying something. So in my figurative work, I use myself and my kids mostly as models, and they're kind of self-portraits. And I think the same could be said of my landscape and my still life. They are, in a way, I think, self-portraits. They're paintings of how I feel about particular places or objects. This is called New Moon. It was done, I think, in January. We'd had a ton of company through the holidays and hadn't been able to paint for about 6 weeks before Christmas because of all the hubbub. And my mother-in-law had sent me these beautiful bulbs to force for a Christmas gift. And when they bloomed in early January, I got inspired to do a painting and to honor the new year, this new growth, new moon, all kinds of things. This is called Self at 30, sort of a documentation of what I looked like 10 years ago, maybe. This is a painting of a dear friend of mine, a childhood friend, who's married now and living in Rome, Italy. She's married to an Israeli fellow, and they live in Rome. And She just had her first baby, who was around the same age as our youngest baby. And they came to visit us and spent a week, it's been about 7 years ago. And as I do with a lot of guests who come to stay for more than a day, I haul them out to the studio and have them sit for a drawing. And she was there while I did the drawing, wasn't there at all for any of the painting. I can do the drawing usually in several hours. But I don't want to have the models there too much. I never use the model when I'm painting. That's all strictly done without the model. But I do use a model when I'm drawing. This is called Some Still Want the Moon. Oh, that last one, I like the title on. It's called Full Bloom. Because Nicole was just a radiant mom. Not, you know, just in the full bloom of motherhood. And again, I like to use the geraniums as a symbol of life and fertility. This is called Some Still Want the Moon. And I did a lot of paintings, and probably still will, of women in front of windows, sometimes looking out, sometimes sitting in front of them. And someone asked me about that once. I'd never really thought about it before I started painting, but when I was asked to articulate what that means, I think what I'm trying to say is I love the outdoors. I love being outside in the natural world, but the domestic life is a very big part of my life, especially in the childbearing and rearing years. And I guess I'm trying to mix both those worlds in these paintings and somehow display the balance between the two. And I think you can have both. And that's sort of what the title is about. Another friend of mine looked at it. She had a daughter the same age, and she said, "Isn't that the truth? You give them everything, and they still want more," which is another interpretation, but, you know, it works. This is a neighbor, Rosie Hamlin. Had her come sit for me. This is a painting of Ada when she was probably about 9 months old. The contrasting views is I'm looking in the mirror drawing. She's looking at my canvas at the drawing. It's just a little wild Christmas cactus. And this is a portrait with Ada. This is called Extra Heavy Duty, which is the brand name on the gloves. They were on my neighbor's clothesline. Rosie, the redhead I painted a few frames back, had these hanging up on her clothesline. I walked out her back door and saw them, and I just was bowled over with their beauty. And so I was kind of embarrassed to say anything about it. I mean, even her, who I know quite well, I couldn't say, "Oh, Rosie, look at those gloves." So I snuck back later when I knew she was gone to town and with my Polaroid camera and took a picture and had it hanging on my wall in my studio for about a week, and I finally decided to paint it. Of course, there's a shed in the background, and, you know, I took quite a few liberties, but the gloves are exactly as they were captured on the camera. This painting is over here in the corner, I think. It's over there, one that I brought. And it's called The Gift of Life. And when I started the drawing or the painting, a friend had given me these flowers as a birthday present in the spring. And I thought, well, I'll do a painting with them. So I did a drawing, and the figure originally had that right arm hanging down. I guess it's left when you look at it this way. And when I finished the drawing, it was really lopsided because you can see how much more blank space there is on the left side of the canvas than there is on the right. And the figure felt crowded on that side, and it just didn't look good. So I thought, I erased the arm on that side. I thought, I've got to do something to activate the space over there. So I just started playing around with my arm, different gestures, and that was the one that worked best visually. So I drew it in, and at that point in time, the painting sort of started, or the drawing started speaking to me as far as content. And this is basically how I work. I would say 95% of my paintings, I just start drawing. And then ideas start coming afterwards. Sometimes I don't really decide what it's about until I'm done with it. But that's how I work. And anyway, I started feeling like this painting was about life. And I like the female figure with this beckoning hand because she is the doorway to life, birth comes through the female body. The doorway represents that passageway and also the passageway of death behind her. And of course, the lilies are a symbol of the resurrection, the cross which she's wearing, and also the cross in the transom above the doorway are all references to Christ. This painting is called How Do You Paint with a Baby?, which is a question I got asked numerous times when Ada was small. And again, the view is I'm looking at the canvas, she's looking at the drawing. And she would actually was quite entertained by that, you know, for 15 or 20 minutes at a shot. This is a painting of Zina when she was probably about 10 or 11. And again, she just sat down to model for me. And it was probably when I was two-thirds of the way through the drawing that content and idea as far as what the painting was about started coming to me. I don't know how many of you remember your adolescent years, but they're very memorable to me. And I remember having really hot and cold emotions about it. On one hand, I did not want to grow up, and I wanted to stay a little kid forever. I remember the first bra my mom bought me, I flushed down the toilet. You know, I don't want this to happen to me. And on the other hand, I would want to be all grown up already. I wanted to be all fully developed, and I wished I was married, and I wished my life was all settled. And I would just flip-flop between these, and because I was terrified of where I was going into young adulthood and growing up and having my body change. And so I remember that feeling, and that's, to me, what this painting is about. I can't remember the title on this, Joe. Do you remember it?
Waiting for Spring.
Okay. My neighbor, Rosie, has a house in Provo, and she'd brought me these forsythia in February. We'd had a warm weekend, and they were just starting to bud. So I had them on the table as just a prop. But also, I think they're very symbolic of this, you know, almost forced budding that I think young girls feel as they begin to change. And that's before her, as is the open book of her life. And then behind her is this young fruit tree and the cold snow, which is, to me, symbolic of the closing of her childhood. And this young tree in this dormant state, she's leaving it behind. And she's sort of sitting there waiting for spring, wondering what will happen. And since the kind of serious expression on her face, it's not meant to be terribly sad, but it's pretty serious because that's what it is. And this is a painting I did of Louisa, I think the same year. She's a couple years older. And again, she just came into my studio to model for me, no idea, no intent. She had her hand on a chair spool. We had some round back chairs that have they have a kind of a dowel coming off the edge. It's turned. And I did the drawing, and I didn't like the way the chair looked bleeding off the page. It was too distracting. And so I erased the chair the next day when I came back in. I usually leave a drawing for a couple days before I start painting on it to make sure that I feel good about the composition. So I erased the chair, but I really liked the way her hand had been around that dowel. So I just put a stick in there in place and thought, well, I'll figure that one out later, but I'm going to leave the hand. And then I started painting. And then as I was looking at it, I think after a day or two I'd been working on it, I thought, you know, that looks like a walking stick. And then this idea started coming to my head. One of the main reasons I had wanted to paint her at this time, because her face was really starting to change. You know how young girls do. They start getting a few more angles in it. And I think she had probably started her periods by now and was starting, you know, more further down the line as far as changing body-wise. And I wanted to try and capture that. And so this piece became called The Traveler, because she's beginning to walk this new path in life, this path of womanhood. And I think that she looks fairly confident and ready to go. And the amaryllis that's getting ready to bud in the background is just another reinforcement of that whole idea. This is my cat, Yuki, who is Joe's biggest competition in life. One of them. And the windows are from the Manti Temple World Room. They're just gorgeous. Big, huge windows that are probably 4 feet deep and 12 feet high, and I've used them in quite a few paintings just because I like them so much. This painting is called The Carpenter's Son. The model is a friend of mine named Ron Staker. He lives down in Mount Pleasant, and he's just a real quiet, soft-spoken guy. He has lots of animals with names. He comes to visit our house, and he spends more time talking to our animals than us. Just one of the most Christ-like, you know, quiet people. But he one time offered to come and model for me. In fact, he said it several times. And I usually don't ask people to model for me because I'm really shy about that. But on the second time, he volunteered. I said, okay, why don't you come over at such and such time? I said, why don't you bring one of your carpenter tools? So he brought this draw knife, which had been his grandfather's. And I knew this would happen, as it does with most people when I do other people, they get really, unless they're a professional model, they get really uptight, you know, when you all of a sudden start asking them to pose. And he was sitting there posing with this draw knife, and it was really rigid and stiff, and it was just awful. And I thought, oh, how can I do this? You know, is this going to be embarrassing? So after two or three starts, this wasn't working. I said, why don't you just hold your hands out like this? Because I'd done a few other paintings recently with objects levitating over the model's hands, and I kind of like that. So I thought, I'll play around with that idea. So I had him hold his hands like that, and he left me the draw knife. He left after I drew his figure, left me the draw knife, and I drew it in. And I finished the painting. The dark shape you can see behind, the kind of the cross shape, was originally wallpaper, and where the flowers are were two windows. But it just looked really dumb. I didn't like it at all, and the thought came through my mind, had been ever since I had the draw knife levitating, this sort of reminded me of Christ. But I was too embarrassed to be overt about any more symbolism. So I thought, oh, I can't do a painting of Christ. But after seeing how dumb it looked, the way I had solved it, I decided, what the heck, I don't have anything to lose. I can't show it the way it is. So I took this dark shape behind him and turned it into a cross. It's actually almost a black or a very dark maroon with red dots all over it that are kind of hard to see in the slide. And then behind, which is symbolic of the crucifix and his death. And the flowers behind are symbolic of the resurrection 3 days later. And the idea of the knife, of course, it's a carpenter's tool, which we know is his trade in life. But the fact that it's levitating over his hand, to me, is symbolic of the mystery of it all. You know, we've heard about the atonement. We've learned about it all of our lives. But it's still, you know, when you get down to brass tacks, how does it work? It's a mystery, and it's a miracle. And so the idea of this tool floating is symbolic of that mystery and the miracle of it. The shirt and time period of that is kind of generic because I kind of don't like painting people from biblical times or in their costume, just because I feel like that reinforces the idea that visually that these people lived back then and what happened back then was for them. And I feel like it's definitely very much a current event and it's for every man, so I try to diffuse that with the clothing that you're not sure when. And the hat is Ron's. Ron always wears a fisherman hat. And so I had to have that in there too. This is Ada. And the telltale sign as far as dating it is the Cheerios on the tray. These are some flowers that my neighbor brought over. Actually, I did two or three paintings of these yellow iris, and by the time I did this one, I think there was only one or two blooms left, but I had been drawing them all week, and again, it's one of these still lifes that was kind of out of my head. I had one or two blooms left, but I just sort of played around and kept turning to get different views to create this still life. That was the first painting I did of those flowers. This one is called Spring. Every year when the earth comes back to life, I get so excited I can hardly stand it. And as I was walking out to my cabin to paint one morning, these little crocuses were just coming up through the lawn, through the snow, and I went out and started this painting. And this was one I think I did sort of have an idea before I started it. I had, like I said, been playing around with this levitation stuff. And so I did kind of have that in mind as I started this. The figure is just out of my head. This is called Young Mother, and it's Ada has this nice little doll cradle that my dad made for her. And that's our cat Marge, who gets abused by Ada in the form of being dressed all the time. But I think that kids learn a lot of the art of mothering through their dolls and through nurturing animals and playing with them. This painting is called Moon Dance, and it's a fairly faithful rendition of this geranium plant. I think I drew it just exactly how it is in front of that window. But if any of you have been in my home, you know that the south view at my window, there's a house. And there's not a mountain scene like that. And I don't know if you'd ever see the moon in that position either out that window. But the inspiration for this painting is the children's book, Good Night Moon. If any of you ever read that one, had that one. I loved that book as a kid, and I've always loved it because of the illustrations. I love the text, too. But if you'll notice, as the story progresses and the room gets darker and darker and it's time for the little rabbit to fall asleep, all of the light in the pictures and the pages is coming from the view out the window. And I just thought that was the coolest thing when I was little. And I noticed that from then on, that it was neat to be in a dark room and look out at all of the light coming in, even at night. And so that's what I was trying to capture, was trying to mimic the beauty, I think, that are in those illustrations in this painting. This is a painting of Zina brushing her hair. Another still life, probably another bouquet that my mother-in-law sent me as a gift. She does that every year, and I really like it. It's a wonderful gift. This is Ada playing with another kitten. I quite often have working titles for these, and then I have decent titles that they go out the door with, and I think my working title for this one was Beastmaster. This one, another one of these gift flowers from my mother-in-law. And I had been working on just a little still life of this, or just a close-up of the blooms, a real small one. And I was about halfway through painting the blooms, and I got the idea for this painting. And so I abandoned that one momentarily, had Joe take a Polaroid shot of me holding my hands out, and then did the drawing and worked on this one for the next week, finished it, and then I went back to finishing the other little still life I'd started with. But it's called Winter Prayer. And again, it's so nice to have these lovely flowers blooming in winter when you're just dying for something like that. And just the idea that I think every year our prayer, the most sincere prayer of our body and soul, is answered, and that the earth does come back to life every year. And we maybe don't always express it verbally, but I think we all feel this yearning. This one is called Recognition, and it was just a self-portrait, one of those. Quite often when I don't know what to do, when I go out to my studio to work and I don't have an idea, which is most of the time, I'll just look in the mirror and start drawing. And this one, nothing really happened, but when I was done with the painting, I thought, wow, that's one of the best likenesses of myself. A lot of times they're fairly distorted, but I thought, this one looks more like me than most. And I really recognize myself in this one. And so then when I had that thought, I thought, my mind flashed to the idea that when I recognize myself most in an inward way, in a spiritual way, is when I am out either on the desert or somewhere far away from city lights and I can see the stars. And there's been something about that from childhood where I feel very small, but there's also some recognition that goes on. I know who I am and I know where I fit in and I know how I fit in the universe. And I've just always had that sense of recognition on a quiet starlit night, so I felt like that was the background that needed to be with this figure. This one was on the cover of Dialogue, I think, last summer, and it's called The Guardians. And again, it's some of these beautiful old pioneer trees. It's painted in my studio. It's a combination of a house in Spring City, a door from another house where we first lived. I love that little door because I would sit there nursing my babies and stare at it with the sunlight coming through those glass. I just have wonderful memories of that. The trees are from another place. The fence is from another place. And the sky is from many evening and morning walks. So it's just kind of a composite picture of my feelings about the town where I live. This is a painting I did in the spring of Joe and Ada planting peas. Another little still life. That's the same one a few weeks later. Another mother and child. I've always done mother and child paintings. And lately, over the last several years, I've been putting a lot of halos on them and making them real obvious Madonnas and children. I grew up in California and had a lot of good Catholic friends and loved a lot of their religious imagery. And I just have always been nuts over the Madonna paintings that you get at Christmas time on the cards and the Madonna stamp that comes out. And finally, about 4 or 5 years ago, I decided, you know, I can do one of those. I don't know why I was so hung up about feeling I couldn't paint, you know, obvious religious symbolism, but I've kind of gotten over that. And you'll see an evolution in these mother and child paintings. I think this one I wound up calling A Sense of Wonder, just for lack of a better title, and it sort of evoked that thought, feeling of about life, to me anyway. Some of the hollyhocks in the front yard. This is, I think I called Sam Pete Landscape or something like that, but Again, this row of poplars doesn't exist in that exact situation, but it's just sort of a memory of a feeling of where I live in the fall. This is called Blue Moon. Again, it just started as a self-portrait or a drawing. And that month that I happened to be painting it, there was a blue moon. Does anybody know what that is? So, yeah, there's a full moon twice in that month, right at the beginning and right at the end. There's usually one each year. And so there was a blue moon going on. That I think it was in February, and I painted it. So I put that in as the background and called it Blue Moon. This is called Morning Ritual. I'm brushing Ada's hair there. Ada likes this one because she said, "Mom, you made my eyes look Chinese." This one is called The Annunciation, and I believe it was on the cover of Quarterly West, the U of U's literary magazine, a couple years ago. And again, it started out as just a drawing of Louisa. She came out to model for me, and originally her head was looking straight directly towards the viewer. Her hand is on a pillar that supports the storage loft in my studio. And when I came out the next day to look at the drawing, I didn't like it. Her neck was too short. I tend to like really long necks on my figures. And so I erased her head. And then she wasn't there to model for me again, so I just had to draw the new head out of my head. And I got that done to where I liked it, but then she looked really funny looking at this post. Before, she'd been looking straight ahead. Now she was staring at her hand on this post. You know, God, what is that? So I erased the post. And then it started working. I started liking it. And it looked like this girl who was looking up and reaching out towards something. And this was right around Easter time. And about a week or so before that, I had had a really profound dream about Mary, Mother of Jesus, and about the Annunciation. And so I started remembering that dream and the good feelings that I had had about it. And so I thought, okay, this is going to be an Annunciation. And again, I went with sort of nondescript clothing from what period, doesn't really matter. I did embellish the yoke on her dress with some 5 minutes. Ooh. Anyway, this is the Annunciation. Go ahead. I'm sorry. I get talking. This is Louisa again, blonde hair. This is my ode to spring, another year, is Persephone, one of my favorite myths. Poppies. I'm just going to really whip through these unless you have questions. This is new potatoes, peas, and onions, which is one of our favorite summer dishes. A child out of my head. Summer still life. Figure with flowers. Love rhubarb. I have this little tub at my studio for Ada to play in. This painting is also here in the corridor, and actually it's going to be at the Sunstone auction on Saturday if any of you are ready to buy a painting. And it's called A Woman in the River Baptism. And I did this after a trip my husband and I took down the Colorado River with friends on a private permit. And it wasn't a very well prepared trip, and we flipped and about drowned the very first day. And we're scared to death because we had about 200 more miles and 2 more weeks of this. And we knew there were a lot bigger rapids to go. But it wound up being the trip of a lifetime in which I felt I was stripped down to absolute bedrock emotionally and physically and in many other ways. And it wound up being a very profound experience and wonderful. I mean, I was in tears when the trip was over. It had just been a life-changing experience. And so this is the granite gorge, that black schist with the pink granite interjected through it, and just kind of a painting of how I felt there. These are datura flowers that grow all over in the Grand Canyon. Called Canyon Passage, kind of juxtaposing the passage by boat, and also there's just jet contrails going over all the time. They're really kind of beautiful. Two different ways of traveling. This is also based on memories from that trip, floating in a little pool, looking up. The view I had is in the next picture, at least my memory of it. It actually didn't look exactly like that, but This is called Cold Moon, I think. Another one of those therapy paintings. This is a painting of Ada out in my studio. I spelled her name around the frame. Ooh, it got in right side this time. Good. Here's another one of those mother and child paintings. Joe brought me a set of stacking dolls back from one of his trips abroad. He knew how much I liked the Madonnas, and he brought these beautiful dolls in Petersburg. We're almost to the end. We're going to make it. This one I think I had in the last church show, and it's called Divine Meditation. The criteria was you had to, living the gospel, all the artwork had to display how you live the gospel. I thought, good grief, what am I going to do? But I just came up with a title that fit one of my paintings. This is another rhubarb painting. I like to paint that every year, too. This one's currently traveling with an exhibit going all around the West to different museums, featuring about 50 different cover artists who've been on the cover of Southwest Art over the last 25 years. They're celebrating their 25th anniversary. This is a neighbor and her little girl. And the last one, this is a real recent painting of Ada. Okay, lights.